Here are your hosts, Michael and Joe.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 21 of the SVOPA podcast for December 2013. And I've got Joe with us today. Are you all right, Joe?
Yeah, I'm fine, thanks. Can't believe we're on 21.
I know, it's definitely moving on, and hopefully we're going to get at least one Christmas, if not two Christmas podcasts out before then as well.
Yeah, don't forget to send us in your merry moment memories. Use us as an audio Christmas card, or send something that you want us to read out, or send us some audio memories from your time at school.
Yeah, and if you want us to ring you and just record it that way, it's dead easy for us to do. So just drop me a message, podcast@svopa.co.uk, because I've only got one at the moment, and if I don't get any more, it's not going to be an interesting podcast, is it?
No, it's going to be pretty empty. And it's just feels rambling on.
It will, and you know, we want as many as we can to get involved, and we are going to do a bit like last year, a round table of people talking about Christmas memories at school. So, you know, that should be something good to look forward to. And got a couple of staff lined up, hopefully, as well, haven't we?
Yeah, we've sent messages out, so we're just waiting for them to get back to us and tell them what time's best.
Yeah, so you know, keep your podcast feed open. And I'm also going to release Tom Glassy's book again as well. I'm going to put that out. So if people haven't listened to it, I'm going to re-release it as a new podcast over the next few months again for you as well, so you can listen to it.
Yeah, we've had some good feedback on that. People who've listened to it have really enjoyed it. So it's definitely worth you going out and listening to that.
And on that one as well, just thinking, I know there are a few other books that have been written by past pupils or staff. If you know about them, because at the end of the day, we don't know. There's a lot we don't know, isn't there?
There is, yeah. Let us know. Just get in touch, podcast@svopa.co.uk.
And if we can get the permission like we did with Tom Glassy's book, we will we'll put them out.
Yeah, don't be shy. If you've written a book, get in touch.
And also, just thinking about that as well, you know, let's have some of your music as well. Someone on Facebook actually said the other day, I don't know if you read it, Joe, or they may have actually mailed me, say, you know, can we do a show of people's music? And obviously we've got loads of musicians and talent. It'd be good to include them, because that was one of the things we wanted, wasn't it?
It was, and the first podcast we did that, every podcast we featured somebody different, so it would be nice to start doing that again. So if you're interested, again, get in touch and let us know what you've got.
So as promised, it's our parenting special this time.
It is. We've got a roundtable discussion with some VI parents.
And we've also got Terry Ballum, who's joined us, telling us about the Disabled Parents Network.
And we've got Lauren Wigglesworth, mum, who's kindly had a chat with Michael about what it's like being a sighted parent bringing up a VI child.
Yeah, and obviously you're going to get the events and everything to go in there as well. And what I think we will do is we'll just move over to a little bit of sad news, unfortunately.
It's with sadness that we need to bring you the news that two past pupils sadly passed away this year. Caroline Wheatman, who was Caroline Miller and left school in 1973, died earlier this year. And secondly, Pauline Heath, who was Pauline Biggie and left school in 1976, died in November. We'd like to pass on our condolences to their family and friends at this time.
Why not come and join us at one, or two, or all of them?
Right, so we're going to move on to the events. So, the Manchester meetup, which we mentioned last month, is taking place this Saturday. So we're hoping to see as many of you as possible, who, especially if you're Northwest based. But there is a change. We've moved it from the Revolution Bar, which is still a really good venue we'll hopefully use again. We've moved it back to the Paramount, where we used last time, mainly for getting a table this busy time of the year. It was just a little bit easier, and the food's a little bit cheaper as well. So that's 12 o'clock at the Paramount, and you can stay as long as you want. And if you're coming on the train, let us know. If you can arrive between 11:30 and 12, we'll meet you ideally at Oxford Road. But if you need meeting anywhere else, drop me a line 07930 444 656 or podcast@svopa.co.uk.
Right, so next we're moving on to next March, and we've got our break in Peterborough, which is running from the 7th to the 10th. And the prices are £40 per person per night on a dinner, bed and breakfast basis. That's for doubles or twins. But there is a single person supplement, so that's £50 per person. And that's at the Bull Hotel, which is, I know we say this every podcast, but it is a lovely building. It's a listed building and they've been very accommodating. They're going to put a guide dog run in the car park. So to book, you need to contact the Bull direct on 01733 561364, quoting SVOPA. And we've got quite a bit of interest already, haven't we, Michael?
We have. I think we've got about 8 to 10 already booked. And just to actually mention a comment I had from last week, the last podcast, and because I sort of said it's more couples at the moment who are booked, and it is, the couples are booked, but obviously that's not, it's not a couples weekend. It is open to absolutely anyone. So, you know, if you're coming on your own, like with the Belmont, you know, you'll probably meet up with new friends. So, you know, it's open to absolutely anyone, you know, and if you want to bring family or a good friend along as well, you know, it's not exclusively just for SVOPA, is it, Jill?
No, it's not. Definitely not. We had a really good mix at the Belmont. We had couples and singles at the Cliff Den. So it's, you know, it's for anybody. Don't hesitate. If you want to come, don't feel, you know, that you can't.
So, we'll hope to see you there.
Okay, so lastly, we've got the main event, which is the school reunion, which is on the 17th of May next year.
It is. So we're just finalising things for that. And we will obviously keep you posted as soon as we have any more information. So check out the Facebook page. And we're hoping to get it all in place so we can start booking around the beginning of March as well.
Why not email us at podcast@svupa.co.uk?
Right, so now we're moving on to the roundtable discussion on VI parenting.
Well, after a long time in the planning, we've finally managed to sort out our VI parenting section for the podcast. So I'd like to welcome, as well as Joe, we've got Yvette. Hi, Yvette.
Hi, Michael.
Hello, Linda.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
And hi, Gary.
Hi there.
Well, you know me and Joe, so what we'll do is we'll just let each person introduce themselves. So, Linda, do you want to just say a little bit about yourself? How many children you've got, when you were at school, that sort of thing?
Julie. Hi, I'm Linda Fitchett, known to most of the St Vincent's people as Bernadette Riley. I was at school in 1960 and went through to 1971. I've been married for 33 years and I have two grown-up children, my daughter Sonia and my son Philip. Sonia has full sight and Philip is visually impaired. I go to work and I'm a very happy person.
Great, thank you very much. And over to you, Yvette.
I'm Yvette Hill. People at St Vincent's will remember me as Yvette Forrest. I was at St Vincent's from 1980 until 1990. After that, I went to mainstream school and then on to university. I'm married to Ian. I've got three children, Christopher, who's five, Emily, three, and Jessica, who's one. And I work part-time 3 days a week as a civil servant.
Right, Jane, and over to you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jane Redfern Gray. I was at St Vincent's between 1979 and 1981. And I'm married to Gary, who you're going to hear in a little while. And we've got three children. We've got Joshua, who's 18. Rosanna, who's 15, and Nathaniel, who's 4.
And over to you, Gary.
Hi, well, my name's Gary Redfern Gray, obviously married to Jane. I have never been to St. Vincent's, but I've heard a lot about it. Same three children, obviously, and but I do work for RNIB for my sins.
Right, well, initially the idea to cover VI parenting was Linda's, but the others have kindly agreed to step in and help out. So we basically, the idea is that we wanted people to kind of know that we can do it just the same as anybody else. Well, that's what we try to do. I'm going to go around and just talk about how you feel firstly about being a parent, I think. What's important to you, maybe what you've done differently. We're all going to have probably different amounts of sight. For me, I'm totally blind, and everybody knows I've just got Jodie, who features on the podcast regularly as well, and she's fully sighted. But some of us have got visually impaired children and some of us haven't. So if we start this time with Yvette, do you want to tell us a little bit about your experience, Yvette?
I am partially sighted, but I'm technically registered blind, although my near vision isn't too bad and my distance vision is reasonably enough. All of my children are fully sighted, and which is beginning to come in handy as my five-year-old is becoming my very own sign reader, bus number teller, and so he's beginning to have his uses. I've got enough sight to push a pram, which is useful. I was very apprehensive about it at first. I thought I'd be running the pram into lampposts and things, but thus far the children have been uninjured and still live to tell the tale.
That's always good.
Yeah.
Okay, so now moving on to Jane. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your experiences, Jane?
Okay, yeah. I think it's fair to kind of say that Gaz and I discussed kind of whether or not we wanted to have kids, and we kind of came to the conclusion that if we didn't, then we would kind of just get on with our lives as we were, even though we were both visually impaired. And so we thought, well, if we can get on okay, then there's no reason why we shouldn't have kids. So, yeah, that was the first kind of discussion that we had. But there was always kind of thoughts in the back of our mind that were like, oh, gosh, you know, how are we going to deal with this? And I hope everything's going to be okay. But then we kind of thought, well, why shouldn't it be? You know, we're quite independent people anyway. So we kind of thought about, considered lots of different aspects, really. So, yeah, that was our thinking from the outset, wasn't it, Gaz?
Yeah, it was. And I think when we were just thinking about the whole should we, shouldn't we have children, and obviously you think, well, if the child is VI, will that make a difference? Well, we're very used to dealing with being VI, obviously. If the child's a different sort of disability, well, what should we do about that? I mean, I just thought we just get on and just cross those bridges if they arose. And I think for me, the main thing was about, it was more the parenting side. I mean, I think when you have your first child, you're thinking, how's this going to affect our lives? And, you know, I hope I'm a good parent. And it was for me, more about being a parent than the actual issue of being a VI parent. And I just knew that, you know, when children come into our lives, they'll just have to come into our world and live in our world. And obviously that, and part of that is about being VI. And but I didn't worry overly much around that.
Yeah.
No, certainly we had all the questions. You know, when I was pregnant with Joshua, we had everything, you know, people making all kinds of comments, and everything from, oh, are you going to have somebody living with you 24/7 now then once you've had the baby, right through to, oh, you'll be absolutely fine, you know, we know you really well and I think you'll make great parents and you'll be absolutely fine. But it was strange that the range of viewpoints that we had to listen to, and sometimes you just really had to grit your teeth with some of the viewpoints that people had.
Yeah, Yeah, definitely. And what about you, Linda?
Well, my experience was that when we got married, my husband and I, we wanted children, and I actually had my daughter very quickly. We'd both had counselling before we got married, and I was actually told that my condition was just for me alone and it wouldn't be passed on. And I went with that thought, and I had my daughter, and she was born with full sight. And I was in a position when I had my daughter Sonia, I was able to push the pram and see her and look after her. Although I did have a health visitor that used to come to the house, and I think she was desperate to find some way where she could imply that I couldn't manage. And the one thing she picked up on was that I bottle fed Sonia, and when I used to put the bottle to her mouth, I just used to gently feel her mouth to make sure it was going where it should. And she was quite horrified and reckoned that I would be passing on my germs to my daughter. So that was a little bit of an obstacle to overcome. I basically just decided that I'd have to just carry on and not take too much notice of any of this. And as I say, I was okay with looking after Sonia. It was absolutely fine. And then when Philip came along, he was two, and I was diagnosed with end-stage glaucoma, and my vision went quite quickly. So I actually had no vision by the time Philip was two, so the pram-pushing days were over by then. And then the other thing that we had to contend with is that Philip was VI himself. He had the same problem as me, which, although I was quite happy to deal with it, it was a bit of a shock at first. However, we just got on with it all, and I basically felt that, sort of echoed Gary's sentiment really, that VI wasn't really an issue because we were all living with it anyway, and Philip would be okay with it as well. And he had useful vision up until the age of 9, and then unfortunately, as a result of cataract operations, he had scar tissue problems. Scar tissue's basically hemorrhaged, and he was then totally blind at the age of 9. So it was quite traumatic, but absolutely fantastic. I wouldn't have had it any other way. I loved having the children. I adored them as babies, loved them growing up, and still absolutely adore them even now, and likewise adore my 4-year-old granddaughter.
That's fantastic. I've got a really controversial question for you all now, and you don't have to answer it, but it's from what you've all said that's just brought this to the forefront of my mind. Had you been told that your children would definitely have been visually impaired if you'd had children, would it have stopped you having children, or would you still have gone ahead and had children? And you don't have to answer it. Jane first.
I absolutely would have gone ahead regardless, and this is controversial because in a sense, as visually impaired parents, it might have been easier if your kids have been visually impaired as well, because there's lots of things that your kids, I mean, our three kids are all fully sighted. And in some ways, and I know it sounds awful, but in some ways it possibly would have been easier in some ways for us, not for them. I wouldn't have wished it on them at all, but it possibly in some ways could have been easier, I suppose, if you want to be controversial.
Yeah.
But it
well,
wouldn't
yeah.
have made any difference. It wouldn't have made any difference to us whatsoever. And yeah, whether they'd been visually impaired or fully sighted, or, you know, one of them visually impaired and one of them fully sighted, wouldn't have made any difference whatsoever.
Right. And Gary, I'm assuming you're in the same.
No, I totally disagree with that. No. I do agree with it. I think I would have been more worried if I'd had a deaf child. I think I would have found that particularly, you know, a lot more difficult.
Yeah,
because of not being able to see the sign language and things. But yeah, I mean, it would have made absolutely no difference, you know, had the child been visually impaired. And in fact, some of the problems that I felt is the whole dealing with this, because I mean, obviously you want your children to fully participate in every aspect of obviously being a child, and but not being able to watch TV with them, and that was one of the things that really and I still, what with Nathaniel now, and he's only four, so not being able to say, look over there at that bird, or look over there, or what's that, and you know, that's on the TV, or what's that over there. And so I kind of feel that he's kind of missed out on that kind of interaction. And I know we can't do that. You know, you just have to get on and do it in other ways. But
yeah.
I think with them being sighted, that gives a different set of challenges, really.
And Linda, I think you answered that before, didn't you, really? But yeah, go on.
I wouldn't have had it any other way. I would have, even if I'd known that... I could have had, you know, the kids may have been VI, I would have still wanted to have them, would never have made any difference. And I've got to say that I totally agree with Jane and Gary that I've got such a special bond with Philip, and I think it is because he's VI, because we can share that, you know, I share different things with Sonia, but with Philip I've got such a special bond, and I believe that is because both he and I are VI, so, you know, I think it has its advantages as well as its disadvantages, and I wouldn't have had it any other way.
And Yvette, how do you feel?
I feel the same as the others. I, you know, if I'd have known one of my children would have been visually impaired and it was a certainty, it wouldn't have changed my mind about having children. I will say it was a relief when they were born and I found out that they hadn't inherited my condition, but if they had have done, you know, it would have just been something that we would have dealt with. And when we thought about it before we sort of talked about having children, the only thing that I feel I haven't been able to do in life is drive. And, you know, if that's all my children couldn't do and everything else is open to them, then, you know, I, you know, thought that was, you know, I don't feel sort of that I've missed out on life because of it.
Right. No, that's brilliant. Thanks. Because you didn't have to answer that at all, any of you, but...
Jo, do you want to answer that question?
Me? Gosh, well, I knew that right from sort of being a child that my eye condition wasn't hereditary, so it wasn't really... I mean, we had Jodie's eyes checked just as a matter of course when she was born, but I pretty much knew that my eye condition wasn't hereditary, so it wasn't something we really had to think about, I suppose. Would it have made a difference? Do you know, I don't know. I'd like to say it wouldn't have made a difference, because I guess who probably makes the best parents for a VI child, a VI person, I suppose, because we understand it. And you get all the fights as well, don't you? But I don't know. I don't know, really.
Just one thing I'll just comment as well, because obviously we've not got children, me and Karen. And not really a conscious decision. It was one of the things where we just never got around to it. But when I was about 19, my mother came home one day and says, I'm pregnant, which is a bit of a shock, really, you know, considering I was an only child for 20 years. And I suppose a little bit like, obviously, as a parent, I suppose is my fear was obviously my brother or sister at the time, I didn't know what it was going to be, were they going to be visually impaired? And that was the one real fear I had while my mum was pregnant. And they both turned out, well, normal as a brother of mine could or a sister of mine could. But, you know, that was a fear as a brother and a brother.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always, if I'm being honest, I think there's always that feeling that you don't want to. If Jodie had been born with a sight problem, and it obviously my parents were told from me being pretty much a toddler that I would lose my sight eventually. That was a given. So I think I'd have felt a bit guilty, I suppose, if I'd have passed that on to Jodie. And I'm, you know, I suppose for that I'm very grateful that she's fully sighted. So I think if I'm being honest, then that probably would have been one of my feelings about it. So, yeah. should we go on to a lighter note? We must all have funny stories about parenting. Well, I'm assuming we do, and we must have all been asked the questions about what's the hardest thing. And I can remember being in a pub at once, and it was somebody very random who I didn't know that well, and just said to me, "What's the hardest thing? You know, oh, how do you do it? How can you be a parent when you're blind? And what's the hardest thing?" And I just looked at her and said, "Well, you try feeding a baby Weetabix at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, when you." You know, and so what would you say is the hardest thing? So let's start with Yvette. What's one of the hardest things that you've had to do, or a funny story, something like that?
I don't know.
Put you on the spot.
Getting up at my three every day is probably the hardest thing. probably the hardest thing is when your child runs off and they're out of sight a lot quicker than they would be for you than they would be for somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you're in a supermarket, you turn around and your two-year-old has vanished and, you know, they're gone. And you're like, where are they? But you can't see them. You know, they could be 10 feet away.
Yeah.
That probably is the hardest thing that I've ever dealt with, my son wandering off in the middle of Marks and Spencer's when he was two. Fortunately, a kind lady saw him wandering off on his own and brought him back. Some mad woman with empty pram walking around going, "Where's he gone?"
What about you, Jane? And Gary, I guess, do it as a couple if you want to, if that's easier.
Okay. Talking about the kids running away, it reminds me of a story that I was walking to school with Rosanna. Was about, I don't know, I think she was about two in the buggy, and Joshua would have been five, and I was walking to school with another mum who had a daughter who's the same age as Joshua, and then we joined some other mums on the way because it was about a half hour walk to get from our area to school. And halfway through the walk, Joshua and his friend disappeared, and we kind of assumed that, oh my goodness, they probably run ahead to school, but we didn't know. So we were in a panic, dashing to school. When we did get to the playground, they were both there, quite happy, blissfully unaware of what they'd done. And I didn't say a lot to Joshua because I didn't want to tell him off and then leave him alone at school for the day upset. But when he did come home, you know, I had to sit down and explain the reasons why he shouldn't run off. And actually, I banned him from watching TV for a week, and I banned him from having any sweets for a week, and I banned him from having any dessert for a week.
Because I'm a cruel mother.
I'm having to emphasise that he must never ever do that again. And I thought, you know, shouting at him is not going to do a great deal of good. But I thought, you know, he needs to, even at the tender age of five, I need to explain why he mustn't do that again. But I just wanted to make an impact and make him realise that he mustn't do that. But it was harder for me to be disciplined to carry that out for a week than it was for him, I'm sure. But yeah, that you know, I can understand. That is really difficult when they do run off. But I think the one thing for me, even bringing up three children, the one thing for me that's been the hardest, that has literally brought me to the point of tears, and you're going to laugh about this, the most hard thing, head lice.
Head lice. Yes.
My goodness, that's
yeah.
Good.
We seemed to go through a period of about 2 years when both the children were coming home with head lice, and every time one of the children ran out of the school, ran out of the classroom, and I felt this narrow strip of paper in my hand, I thought, you don't need to read that to me. I know exactly what it is. But the sheer kind of disruption of constantly combing and combing and combing. We spent literally, I don't know, so much money on solutions,
a fortune on treatments.
Yep.
And the thing is, you can't see whether your children have got head lice or not, or whether whether since now you've treated them, they don't have it anymore. So yep. You just get these notes that somebody in, you know, it's like the lottery. It could be you. Could be your child. Oh, it's so frustrating.
Yeah, it is.
And we spent pounds and pounds on all these different sorts of combs, ones that would bleep and ones that would do this and do that, and none of them worked. And
No.
I used to spend hours queuing up at the health centre to say, I've had a letter, I've treated my children, please could you check that I've got rid of everything? But, there seem to be always, you're always going to get it, whoever you are and whichever school you're at, there's always going to be some parent who doesn't really bother, and then you end up in the same old position again. And that situation, more than anything else, literally brought me to the point of tears.
Yeah, I can understand that. What about you, Linda?
Well, I must say, I do echo the sentiment about the headlights. Of course, that was quite a big issue. I used to always get my mum to have a look when she came, just to check. I mean, they were constantly having their heads checked, poor kids. But one of the things I do remember is that Philip, at the age of 12 months, was actually having to wear glasses, and we used to have to tie them on with an elastic band at the back so they would be secure on his head, and he hated them. And if we went out, he would inevitably pull them off and drop them somewhere, and I would have people knocking at the door and handing me these glasses. Did you know your son dropped his glasses halfway along the road? So it was a real nightmare trying to keep him with his glasses on. Yeah, just, I mean, I just sort of echo what everyone else has said, really. The everyday things that every sighted person perhaps takes for granted, things where you really do need vision to be able to deal with. Some of that could be a bit tricky, but we always seem to find our way around these things as VI people. And I think, apart from, as I say, constant loss of glasses in my house, things weren't too bad, really.
Is there any advice that any of you would give to would-be parents out there that perhaps are thinking, should I, shouldn't I? I remember a young woman asking me once, just the simple things, how do you go about, with a pram or feeding and just the general things. And is there anything you would say, or would you just be generally encouraging? What would what would your advice be, or anything like that, to anybody out there who's umming and ahhing about it, or perhaps thinking, will I be able to do it, or will I be, useless at it? Because I guess we all go through that, don't we? So I can't remember who we're up to, so we'll go with Yvette.
I would say just go for it. Most things you'll find a way round, and the others you'll just fudge and find your own way. When you talked about the Weetabix at 7 in the morning, what I've done with mine is something called baby-led weaning, where you don't do any spoon feeding at all. And what you do is, from when they're about 6 months, you just plonk chunks of food on their high chair, and you leave them to pick it up and eat it themselves. Which saves trying to find a mouth with a loaded spoon, and then they flick it all everywhere, and it's messy. And you have the opposite problem of, you end up crawling around the floor trying to find what they've discarded over the side. But that I did find made my life easier, and it also meant that when you went to eat out and things, you could just give them whatever you were having, and if you got stranded somewhere, then you could just give them something, rather than having to sort of hunt out for a jar of baby food. You could just say, here you go, have a banana or have something.
Right, that's interesting. What got you onto that event was.
It was, well, my son, I did spoon feed, which ended up being a process of him turning his head away and screaming at me. And my friend had done this with their twins, and she said, oh, you should give it a go. And got to my second child, and I thought, oh, I've got nothing to lose. So I gave it a go, and it was so much easier. And I find that both my daughters I've done it with, and they are so much less fussy than my son was, because they've just been used to being given whatever we're having for dinner. They're just given from the word go. Sometimes minus a tomatoey sauce. So their dinner might have been, if they were having a pasta thing, it might have been taken out the pan before the tomato sauce got added to it. So they might have just had pasta and vegetables rather, but that was mainly so that I didn't have to get it out their hair afterwards. But it did make sort of life easier, trying to sort of get a spoonful of yoghurt into their mouth.
Yeah. Jane, Gary?
Yeah, with the feeding, I kind of developed my... I mean, everybody develops their own way, don't they? Because, you know, feeding a baby in a high chair is a real messy business. And I tended to use... I mean, what you can do, you can buy... instead of buying just a normal bib, what you can buy now is like a... It's almost like an overall, really, so that you put their arms through and it fastens around the back so that they're completely kind of covered. So I used those because they were easy just to take them off and chuck them in the washing machine. But it meant that when you took it off, the clothes stayed clean.
That's a really good idea.
Rather than just a standard bib. Mm. The other thing I did was I had a set of little cloth, and I used to keep a little dampened cloth on the corner of the table of the high chair. And then what I used to do, because I'm right-handed, I used to take my left hand and kind of cup baby's chin in my left hand with my thumb just underneath their bottom lip, and I would use that as a kind of a guide for putting the spoon in their mouth. And then obviously if I took my hand away because it had got a bit of food on it, just take my left hand away and just wipe it on the edge of the cloth each time so that it was clean when I put my thumb back under his chin again.
Yeah.
And just develop that kind of method, really. And then you find as baby gets a bit older, they naturally, as you put the spoon towards them, you find that their head moves forward towards the spoon. Eventually, they learn that trick very quickly.
Yeah.
They do if they like the food. But when they don't... So Joshua was, he was the worst for, I love the sweet stuff, I hate the savoury stuff. So he'd be turning his head, and then once he'd got the spoon, he'd be spitting it everywhere. And just nightmare. The thing is, that's gonna happen. Just deal with it. It's going to happen, whether you're blind or not. And I think, you know, you don't want to think, oh, how will I be able to do X? How will I be able to feed my child or change a nappy or whatever? And changing nappies, oh boy, that's another one. You know, and particularly, I'm talking about hard things. Changing, and what I think my pet hate is changing a nappy in public when you know that people are going to be staring at you thinking, oh, how's this blind man going to be able to do this?
Yeah.
You know, and if it's a really bad one, oh, it's really not good. But, you know, you just have to go for it because, you know, these things are going to come up. You're going to get over them. You're going to find work around them. And I'd hate to think that you're not going to have something as wonderful as a child because you worried how you were going to look after it because
that's
normally you can,
somebody from church, a friend of ours, he asked me once, he said, Jane, how does a blind person change a nappy? And I paused and then I just looked at him, smiled and said, carefully.
Yes, with an awful lot of baby wipes and wet cotton wool. Yeah. What about you, Linda?
Well, I think just do what we do best in the way that we do it best and you'll make absolutely brilliant parents. I think don't let anybody put you off. You know, people do want to watch you doing things. So you are a bit of a novelty to them if you can't see. But just forget all that and just do what you want to do in the way that you do it, and I'm sure everything would be brilliant.
Do you know, I was just thinking about something that happened to me. My sister-in-law is fully sighted, and she hadn't had children, and her and Rob's brother were planning on having a family, and I remember Jodie was still in nappies, and she actually asked me, she said, can I come upstairs with you, Joe? She said, and can I change Jodie's nappy? She said, and can you show me how to do it? And I went, yeah. And it made my day because I thought, actually, somebody sighted is actually asking me, can I help them? And it was nice because there was no, you know, it wasn't that whole thing, how do you do it? You're blind, blah, blah, blah. And I think that's it, isn't it? Just get in there and do it and find ways around it. And,
definitely.
You know, and don't miss out on having something as wonderful as a child. Because people tell you you can't, or because you think you can't, because you probably and invariably can.
And do it better than the rest, no doubt.
Yeah. Is there anything else before we finish that anybody wants to add or bring up, or, you know, that you think would be interesting for anybody or helpful?
I'm sure we've all got funny stories that we can tell. I'm sure we've all got them about things that have happened to us. I mean, I've got absolutely tons of them. I remember one day when Josh was about two, and I came home with a load of shopping, and he was wanting to help me put the stuff away. So no problem. I handed him tins of things to put in the cupboard, and we did it all together. It was all great fun until the next morning when I thought, Weetabix for breakfast. Where's that? And I searched for it every single cupboard, couldn't find it, came to the conclusion that I'd left it on the belt on the at the till at the supermarket. And it wasn't until about two or three days later, when I opened the freezer to look for some ice cream, that I found the Weetabix. Thanks to my little helper, bless him. Yeah. And then another time when he was about, I think he must have been about two again, when I was stood in the bus queue to come home at the bus station, and we'd called at the shop to buy a bar of chocolate or something, and the lady in front of me turned to Josh in his pram and said, "Oh, are you enjoying your orange juice, darling?" And I thought, orange juice? And he'd helped himself to two cartons of orange juice from the shelf in the shop.
I've actually got quite a funny one as well. When Sonia was very tiny, she used to like to open all the cupboards in the kitchen and play with the pans and the pots and everything like that, which was absolutely fine. And I remember one afternoon, she got herself in there and all the usual things came out and all the lids of the saucepans, and she was happily playing with them and talking to them and everything. So I popped into the lounge and quickly got the Hoover out and whipped around, as you do. Came back and she was really, really quiet, just sitting there as quiet as anything. And then I suddenly noticed that she was chomping on something. I thought, well, there's nothing here. What on earth's going on? So opened her mouth, and there I found a handful of cat biscuits. Lift up the cat bowl from the kitchen floor when I went out to do the hoovering. And, of course, she'd obviously seen it and helped herself to the cat food. sitting there chomping away on them.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I think it was totally my fault for leaving them on the floor, of course. But obviously she thought that would be quite nice for her afternoon snack.
I think if they're going to do that, I remember Rosanna, she was in a playpen, and, you know, she used to like it in the playpen, a load of toys in there, but we had left a tub of Sudocrem near the playpen, and she'd managed to get it in. I'm not sure whether she'd got it through the bars or whatever. I don't know how she got it in there, but we didn't realise this, and that's the thing. You can't see what they're doing. You know, actually, the fact of life, you know, you just have to get on with it, but...
Yeah.
Man, she had covered everything herself and the rest of the planet in this pseudogram. And of course, it's so hard to get off. It's just, So, you know, they're gonna do this. They're gonna do this stuff, and it's all just part of the. That's all part of the fun most of the time, I think.
yeah, most.
I thought I didn't have a funny story. You've just reminded me. I was in the kitchen getting dinner ready just before I went to pick my eldest up from school, and my three-year-old came running in, and she goes, "It's snowing, Mummy." And I turned around, what do you mean it's snowing? And she opened her hands, and she had two handfuls of beans from the bean bag in her hand.
Oh.
And then I said, "Where'd you get these from, the bean bag?" "It's snowing, Mummy, like on Peppa Pig." I went into the living room. There were beans everywhere. I did my best to tidy them up. I had about 10 minutes until school. And then when we got on the way back from school, I said to my five-year-old, "Mummy's got a really important job for you. When we get home, I'm going to give you the Hoover and see how many bits of beans you can find." Thinking one-year-old beans, not a good combination. So I was petrified of the baby scooping up these beans and eating them. Three-year-old thought it was hysterical, and the five-year-old, bless him, actually went round and hoovered up all the beans before my husband got home from work. He's like, never turn your back on a toddler.
No.
Fatal.
Another interesting thing was we asked over dinner one night, because we've never actually talked with the children about me being visually impaired, and we had a conversation with the children over dinner, and we asked the 5 and the 3-year-old, can mummy and daddy see well? And they both came out with, mummy can see well, but daddy can't because he wears glasses. Now, my husband is fully sighted. It just goes to show that so they haven't picked up on anything yet, and their friends haven't sort of said anything, you know, in school to my son either. So I just found that really interesting. You know, he's got to 5 and he hasn't noticed, you know, that I'm visually impaired, which I thought was quite interesting, that, you know, because daddy wears glasses, daddy can't see very well, and they both, probably my daughter was following suit with my son, but that was, you know, their reasoning at their age. So, you know, they clearly haven't seen sort of any difference really between what mummy can do and what daddy can do.
Oh, that's interesting. Anything else? Anybody?
Can I just say a little bit about maybe about schooling as well? Because
yeah, of course you can.
With Philip, he obviously being visually impaired, he actually went to mainstream, and I now actually teach in mainstream. So I've actually experienced my son going to mainstream, teaching in mainstream, and also my going away to special education. My feeling is that, you know, special education, mainstream, they suit some children, they don't suit others. Philip was very lucky. He was able to go through mainstream and just work alongside his sighted peers in the way that both my husband and I wanted him to. And I think, you know, that was brilliant because obviously he was in an education where, you know, what everybody was hoping he would be able to do. But don't let anybody force you as parents into doing anything you don't want to. If you genuinely feel that your child is going to be better off somewhere that, you know, they're going to benefit from, dig your heels in and say, you know, no, I really don't want my child going to the school you're saying. I want to consider other options. I think the LEA tends to think that everybody wants to go to mainstream and that's what it's for and everybody should be there. But that isn't always the case. What works for one doesn't work for everybody. So, you know, be firm as a parent. Say what you want, not what they want you to say.
That's a good point. And we are actually, I think, in a future podcast, Michael will tell me on this, I think we're going to cover mainstream sort of versus specialist education. Not that it's a competition as such, but that,
no.
You know, to kind of talk about how different people cope in different environments and how some suit, you know, it might suit one person but won't necessarily suit another.
Something that happened last week that I found really interesting, actually. We went to Nathaniel's first parents' evening and we were talking about Nathaniel learning his letters. And I said that I'd got some magnetic letters that had also got Braille on them. And his teacher said to me, well, when you're spelling out the words for him, you know, just simple three-letter words or whatever, she said, do you make him touch the letters and feel them? I said, no, why do you ask that? She said, because when I'm teaching him to do his writing, when he's written it, he always puts his fingers across it to, as if he's feeling it as well. And I said, no, that's probably just because he's seen us read Braille. So we had a bit of a giggle about it. But I was explaining this to somebody that I teach, one of my students who is also totally blind. He has a 6-year-old fully sighted son. And he said, that's amazing. He said, because when his son was only 4 and started at school and going through the same process, he did exactly the same thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
There is one thing that I was told by when we lived in Preston with a friend who used to do, you know, the spot checks on nurseries to see if they were up to standard and everything. And when she found out that I had Jodie, she said that in her experience, she would imagine that a visually impaired parent, their child would kind of begin to communicate sometimes more often, more quickly than a child who had a sighted parent. And I was a bit sceptical about this, and I've spoken to other VI parents about it, and we've kind of come to the conclusion that we think it's because we communicate more. Because I know when Jodie was little, everything I talked to her all the time, you know, I didn't point at anything for us, but you know, and if she pointed, she had to communicate with me. And I think that is probably the case. I think I would agree with what she said, that Jodie began to communicate. I mean, she was counting and reading before a lot of people that I knew who were sighted and had sighted children.
I'd absolutely agree with that. I do think their vocabulary develops quicker because we're always talking to them.
Yeah.
And lots of people have always said, with all our three children, gosh, they're speaking really, really well, you know. And I think it's because we spend more time talking to them, and they're not allowed to just point at something. If they want something, they're not allowed to point at it.
Yeah.
They have to articulate themselves.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Yeah, that's exactly right.
I noticed with my granddaughter, because obviously my daughter and her husband are both sighted parents, and I noticed that there is a difference between my granddaughter and my daughter. My granddaughter doesn't talk to me as much, despite the fact that I talk to her. She isn't as communicative, and I'm sure it is because they have such a lot of eye contact between the three of them that she forgets that she has to talk to me, and that she isn't allowed to point to things or nod at me or anything like that. But it's definitely there, you know. There is a difference. The sighted child tends to be quieter, I think, than you know, those with VI parents.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks ever so much for taking part.
It has. It's been fantastic. Really grateful for you, Linda, Yvette, Jane, and Gary for joining us, spending some time with us, and bringing a real insight as well. And we hope, you know, other potential or parents we'll get something out of this as well. And obviously, they'll have shared similar experiences. Yeah, I want to thank everyone for taking part in the discussion. It was really interesting. I mean, I was obviously a bystander, really. But I found there some really interesting topics covered, and quite amusing, quite touching as well. And so thank you very much to all the guys who took part in there. Right, I would like to introduce Terry Ballum. She is the chair of the Disabled Parents Network, and she's just going to tell us a little bit about what they do and what support is available. So, hi, Terry.
Hi there, Michael. Hi, yes. Right, well, I thought I'd like to tell you a little bit about the organisation that I run and I'm also a trustee for. Disabled Parents Network provides information, advice and support to disabled people who are or aspire to be parents. Because I am visually impaired myself and have three children, I provide the peer support specifically for blind and partially sighted parents, because quite often there are lots of barriers or challenges that one experiences, things that perhaps we haven't thought of before we have the children, or for example in my case my vision deteriorated very rapidly during pregnancy. So we provide that information, advice and support, signposting to possible sources of support, possible pieces of equipment, and the opportunity to connect with other people in similar experience, rather than you having to struggle to think about solutions. Perhaps one of the most obvious issues would be, you know, perhaps mum wants to breastfeed or doesn't wish to breastfeed and needs to bottle feed. How do you do that then? How do you make the bottles up if you can't see? Of course, it's very simple for those of us that know about the technology quite often. You can weigh the water and then put the scoops in. One of the other challenges is about getting out and about. You know, if you're a long cane user or a guide dog user, you may decide to just carry your child in a backpack, in a front carrier or in a backpack. But you may wish also to use a pram. And I know of lots of VI parents that do that by actually pulling the pram or a pram behind them. Reading with your child, preschool and the school work, you know, information. How do you get the information from school to home? Reading books, etc. Those are the kind of challenges. There are various organisations that many of you probably will know about, such as Caliber, the RNIB's library, Clear Vision, etc. So those are the kind of things that we do as an organisation. Our focus really is on the parent who is disabled. So it's about helping the parent overcome the barriers that they might experience in carrying out their parental role. What we do with them, and that may be that, you know, the parent is visually impaired and also has visually impaired or disabled children. And in that case, what we would do is we would try and simply to signpost them to local sources of support. We also work with professionals. So we actually have, you know, for example, a referral protocol with the RNIB. So we actually work quite well with the RNIB in that, you know, if they have any queries from parents, then they will refer them on to us, and then we will try and again signpost them or help them directly depending on what the particular issue is.
Right, Terry, what is the best way of people getting in touch with you?
Well, the best way would actually be via email, which is information@disabledparentsnetwork, and that is all one word, .org.uk.
Well, thanks very much for your time, Terry. It's been great speaking to you, and I'll see you again soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Why not follow us on Twitter?
Thanks, Terry, for doing that for us. And now we're going to hand over to Lauren's mum, Dawn.
I'm going to introduce Dawn now. She's Lauren's mum, Lauren Wigglesworth. So hi, Dawn.
Hi, Michael.
Are you okay?
I am very well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm not so bad. It's been one of these things. We've been planning to do this chat for a while. We've finally managed to get it sorted, haven't we? So well, one of the things we thought we'd do on the podcast was actually be nice to speak to a sighted parent who had the pleasure of bringing up a visually impaired child. And Dawn offered to do this. So, Dawn, you were saying earlier, before obviously Lauren was born, you had no connection or any indication of visual impairment?
No, none whatsoever.
Apart from giving to guide dogs, like you were saying.
Yeah, apart from, yeah.
And now you can't get rid of one because it's always sleeping around the place and causing trouble.
Two, actually, a retired one and a working one.
Up to Lauren being born, you obviously had no idea she was going to be visually impaired. How did that sort of go, and sort of how did you feel?
At first, it was really, really upsetting because, well, obviously Lauren was a twin, and bringing up a normal child and then bringing up a blind person, it was like, how can I describe colours, trees, boats in proportion with the sea and things like that? How am I going to get to read? How am I going to get to get on in life as everybody else does? There was lots and lots of questions that were endless. and there was no one to ask.
So you didn't really have much support around when in the early years then?
No, there was no support whatsoever.
So obviously you had a fully sighted son. Obviously you couldn't give Lauren too much more attention than your son. How did you find that?
Well, to be honest, I think it's probably just as well that she was actually a twin, because I think if she wasn't a twin, it might have been a little bit more mollycoddled and doing more for them than actually letting them do things for themselves. If my son was doing anything, I'd make sure Lauren did it. If he had so much of my time, she'd have so much of my time. Feeding, it was one, and then it was Lauren. You know, there was never really, I didn't really make any differences or give her any more treatment, apart from if she needed it medically.
I suppose because of that, did Lauren, develop quite quick at some of her skills? And
yep, because I brought her up like that, she developed really, really well. She played out with the other children, although I was watching. We did try and give her as much social life as well as homework. When I did the homework with my son, I made sure I learned Braille and did that with my daughter, with Lauren. If she played in the street, Lauren was allowed to play in the street. There was things that she couldn't do, but as far as I knew that she was safe and I could see, I let her get pretty normal life as possible, really. That's why she's ended up so independent now, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she is independent. I know her quite well now. And obviously she went to St Vincent's, which I went to a good few years before. How did she do any mainstream, or did she go straight into...
No, to be perfectly honest, I wanted Lauren to go into mainstream, but we're going back 20-odd years and there wasn't the support that they do get now. I would have preferred her to be in a classroom, obviously, with a brother. Mm-hmm. But because the support wasn't there, there was no Braille, there was no nothing like that, it was impossible. They did want her to go residential, but in the time that she left her primary school, Shawgrove, to go into St Vincent's, unfortunately her dad died, and then I wanted her on with me all the time so that I could keep me on and make sure she wasn't grieving and all that. So she did stay with me and came home, did the journey every day, apart from when she got near the end, she went to a local school on a Friday that was a mainstream school, and it was absolutely brilliant with her. And they had all the support set up for the one day a week.
Right, because that was one of the things when I was there, we didn't actually have that facility where we could go to a mainstream school. But saying that, back in the 60s, I think it was, we had obviously one of the earlier interviews with Kevin Carey, chair of R&RB. That was something what did happen years gone by a little bit more. So it's strange how things come full circle as well.
I think all blind people should be in mainstream schools, even if it's just for the social part of it, because you leave St Vincent and all your friends are all distant.
There is that, yeah, I agree.
You're socially excluded straight away.
It's good to spend some time with visually impaired, but it's important that we get that social skills so that we can mix really well, which I know you've really encouraged Lauren to do.
You've got to be, because you only have one life anyway, don't you? And just because you've got a visual impairment doesn't mean to say that you can't do things in life. I mean, there's certain things you can't do, but if it's manageable and achievable, push as much as you can to get to the goalpost.
Right, so have you got any stories you want to tell about when she was younger, or, well, even up to yesterday, I suppose?
To be honest, there's just loads that come to mind, but there's one, and I don't know why she always did it, but wherever we went, we always had to stop while she kissed the car when we got out of the car. Don't know why it was. You know, it was just one of them stupid things that she did. Mm-hmm. She was always in a baby, you know, one of them baby bouncers.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to love it when you used to really push her really high so she could get the feeling from it.
I suppose it's like me when we go to anywhere, like Disney World or a place like that. It's the physical ride sometimes which actually have more of an effect than the visual ones, obviously, because you're missing out on them. So the physical...
She never wanted to be in your arms. She always wanted to be in this baby bouncer.
Right.
She'd sleep in it, she'd eat in it, she did everything in it. Yep. And then if we used to go shopping, that was the ultimate. I'd have Brad on one arm and Lauren on the other. And if she was being naughty, I'd say, right, I'm leaving you here. Not like Mum's doing, say, right, I'm going.
Yeah.
And my son would be screaming, get a mum, and he'd run back to her. Yeah, if it was on the other foot, and I'd say, right, I'm leaving you here, she'd say, quick, run, Mum. Run away from him.
So Brad was very supportive of her then.
Very.
Mm-hmm. And how did he find things? Did he
suppose, resent anything or any, but you like, so you didn't really get any more attention anyway, no. Did you? So
no, apart from medically, and we used to have to go along to France a lot of the time while she had surgery and that. Mm-hmm. And he gave up his schooling and everything. And even one time, I couldn't stay with her at the hospital because she had to have a nurse with her. And he was screaming and saying to me, "Mum, you should be with Lauren. You should be with Lauren." He really did have a really good bond with her.
Mm-hmm.
But even when he used to take her out, he used to say, have her on his arm and say, "Right, come on, Lauren, let's go." And he'd say, "There's a step, and there wouldn't be a step there, so she'd fall over." He'd put his arm out and say, "Lamp post and bang her head," and things like that.
Yeah, that's his brothers for you, isn't it?
Yep.
And I bet she did things to him as well.
Yeah, but she still argues with him now, but they have real good bonding.
Oh, that's good, yeah. And I think, obviously, the fact she was home at night time as well would have benefited.
Yeah, I don't think it would have been fair on Lauren or myself or her brother if she was sent away and not coming on Monday to Friday.
So is there anything else you want to just sort of, anything we've missed?
I don't really know. Just at the time, there was just no support whatsoever. No one used to tell you how to... I know it comes easy playing with a child, but it's a bit harder playing with a blind child because it's completely different. I could play with Brad.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easier, but you play with Lauren, and like even when she was a baby and she was lay there, she didn't know where her feet were or her arms or anything like that. And it's having to make them aware of parts of the body. And there was no one there to give you a little bit of feedback or play therapy. There was nothing.
Mm-hmm. That's it. I mean, some people seem to have a lot, and like obviously you've never got that support at all.
No, we've never had any support. Mm-hmm. We've even had to buy a brailler, a canes. We've had to buy everything.
So I suppose just moving on, obviously, how have you found, obviously, now Lauren's a young adult and obviously gone on into the world and done a lot more. How have you found that as a parent and letting go more as well?
Yeah, at first I found it really, really difficult to let go because one, she was blind, two, she was a girl. And I used to have all different things going through my head, and then I thought, no, it's my selfishness that is holding her back. And to make the first journey, to do anything the first time, when they can't come home, the second time's not as hard. So now sometimes I do get a bit apprehensive about doing things, but I would never, ever let her know that, and I would never stop her from doing anything that she wants to do, unless obviously her safety's compromised.
Yeah, of course. No, I think that's good, because obviously so many parents don't always have that confidence to just let them try it and go for it.
You never know the potential if you don't let them do it.
No, you don't. I agree. Thanks a lot, Dawn. It's been fascinating actually talking to you and obviously getting a bit of insight because, I mean, I've not been a parent and I'm pretty much not likely to be a parent.
It's quite bloody hard work, to be honest with you.
I'll just stick to a couple of dogs.
Well, I've got five of them in the house now.
Five?
Yeah, we've got five dogs.
Oh, you're just mad.
But I love them better than people. I'm getting another dog and getting short of Lauren.
Thanks very much, Dawn.
All right, then. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Well, that brings us to the end of episode 21. Thanks for joining us. It's been an awful lot about parenting this month, but if you've anything that you would like us to cover in the future, get in touch because we'd be happy to do it, wouldn't we?
We would. And as we mentioned earlier, we might do a topic on, like I said, specialist education and mainstream education. So, you know, other topics as well, you know, let us know what you want to cover and we'll do it.
Yeah, definitely. So, thank you to everybody who took part, to Jane and Gary, to Linda, to Yvette, to Terry and to Dawn.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you all and it's been good to have some new people on as well for the first time. So that's been really good as well.
Yeah, so all that remains is for us to give you the all important contact details. So you can get in touch by emailing podcast@svopa.co.uk.
You can search on Twitter and Facebook just by searching SVOPA.
You can find us on Audioboo, and that's SVOPA. You can also listen to Michael's and my ramblings. And we do audio booze from events, so it's not just our personal stuff. So that's Ike Allen, IkeAllen, and joe.fishwick.
And if you want to get in touch with me direct, it's 0161 287 1841, or my mobile 0793044656. And if you want to catch up on all the old podcasts, just go to www.svopa.co.uk.
Okay, so that's all the ways you can get in touch. And all that remains is for us to say we'll see you next time for the Christmas podcast. So don't forget those merry moment memories.
Yeah, and until next time then, Joe, I'll speak to you again soon. And bye, everyone.
Bye.